I am the vice president of the ELCA. I say that very quietly. I kind of thought maybe we wouldn't have anybody at this forum tonight. I could go home and go to bed. This is kind of exciting. What I want to do this evening is share just a few things with you in terms of some visions and some things I see happening within the church that are possibilities and potentials. But I also want to make sure that this evening you get an opportunity to ask questions, to share concerns, to share hopes and dreams. And I really do take sessions like this real seriously in terms of sometimes I jot down notes, sometimes I file it back in my head. Because oftentimes when the church council is in the midst of meeting and making, you know, its decisions and kind of mired down in the nitty-gritty, it's important to be able, at least for me, to say, hey, I know there's a group of people who I heard from who are saying this, and I think we need to listen to that. And from there, then the discussion moves. I think that becomes real important for those of us who are in that arena of policymaking to always have our ears attuned to what people are saying throughout the church. And it's one of the reasons why I accept a lot of speaking engagements is not so much because I think what I have to say is so very crucial to people, but more because it puts me in contact with a lot of people so that I can listen. As we all know, the tendency oftentimes in our lives is to hang out with only those people that, you know, we're used to being with, and they're like us and they function like us and they think like us, etc. And that's not very helpful, I don't think, for the kind of decision making that needs to take place in the church. So I think what I would like to do first is not share what my vision and some of my hopes and dreams is more hear from you first, and then kind of end the session with some of those, as well as some challenges that I would have for you, as well as for myself, as we move towards the year 2000. I think that that the church and this time of history is a really exciting one, especially as we look at moving into a new century. One of the things that happened about a month ago, there was a futures conference that the church held and had church staff there, etc. And one of the things a lot of those futurists said, and these were primarily people who were not part of the church, who did not have a role in what the church did, but more were people who were listening to what they thought the future trends were going to be. And one of the things they said very clearly is that they see people really struggling and asking for what's happening in terms of their spiritual life and their relationship to the church. And they felt, as scientists and all different kinds of scientists, that was something they couldn't deal with at all. And that they really felt that the church was the place that needed to intersect with people around that, because what was happening is the human potential movement and some other places were jumping in, and they really felt the church had a real important role in that kind of future thinking and how it interacted. So I do see this as a real exciting time. It has the potential of also being a very painful time, because we don't take the change too easily as Lutherans. And so we're going to have to struggle a lot with a lot of things. But I guess if one can see the hope in that, then it makes the struggle a little more easy and a little brighter in terms of our ability to function on a day-to-day basis. So I'm going to limit my comments now to that, and I would just really like to hear from you. Let me also... you want to introduce yourself and tell what your role is, and you can kind of focus if people have questions from the regional point of view.
Well, okay, I'm Jim Broughton, and I'm from Seattle. I work with the ELCA, fortunately deployed to Seattle, and I work in the regional office with Region 1, which constitutes six synods in Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Montana, and Alaska. I work with the Division of Congregational Life, special emphasis on witness evangelism, and just general information. Our regional office is the only region that really works as a centralized team.
Okay, good. So that we have a good resource person in terms of if their regional questions are concerned, and I'm sure you'll also be listening as people do talking. Okay, thoughts, questions, let's start anywhere and see what you have to say, and then we can move the discussion. Who would like to start?
I was out of the country when all this happened. What's different?
Thanks for starting with such an easy question. Well, I probably would answer that question less with what's different than what potentially could be different. And I think we're at the stage in the ELCA, which is much like a family that comes together, a family with stepkids and stepparents who are struggling hard to learn to live together, even though we all look a lot alike and we all, from the outside, I've heard outside people ask me, why is it such a struggle for the ELCA to form? You all, I mean, what's the difference? What was the difference between the three church bodies and why is it such a struggle? And to some on the outside, that is true. However, inside, there are a lot of us who come from traditions that we like to hold on, you know, as if we're on the sinking ship and we're not going to let them go. So I think for now, one of the things that's happening in the ELCA is there's a lot of grieving going on for what has been left behind. But there's also some beginnings of renewals. I think one of the things that is different and that is even more potential is the whole issue of inclusivity. Now, the problem we're having with inclusivity is that we've dealt with it up until now as a numbers game. How many people we have on boards and how many people we have in terms of our membership, and not only people of color, but also women, and all kinds of inclusivity. But basically, we've seen it in the mode of numbers. The problem that we're having now is suddenly we're having to deal with integrating it into our system. What does it mean to have women as a major part? What does it mean in terms of decision making? What does it mean to have other ethnic groups or people of color as a part of the group? Does it mean you just sit around and sit back and say, gosh, isn't it nice? We kind of represent a whole variety of things and this is good. Or does it really mean that we're willing to radically change our system to take the gifts that those people bring to make it a part of the system? I think that's a struggle. I mean, we deal with it on the church council. The church council functions much like it functioned in the other church body in a very traditional, orderly way. We have four-day meetings. Our agendas are about that thick. And, you know, we use Robert rules, although I have a tendency to try to deal with consensus and focus people in on that first and use the voting only kind of as the last point of contact if we can't get to consensus. But certainly the issue I struggled with is we have, you know, they're 50% women, they're people of color. What is it that would be different? Do people process information differently? Everybody's not task-oriented. Some people are more process-oriented. Some people make decisions in a very different way. And I think it's called us to ask some very different questions than we've asked before. I think that's also happening in churches and synods and regions. And it's going to be a struggle for us because now we're at the point of now we've not only given up some slots for people, but now we're going to have to be able to let go, not completely, but be willing to, and I wouldn't even use the word let go, be willing to encompass some other traditions. And I think that's going to be much tougher for us to deal with. Because unless we do that, the issue of inclusivity is out the window, and I don't think it's going to make any difference. What I find different in the church in that is that it's being talked about and struggled with. And, you know, that to me is exciting. We have a lot of failures, but it's exciting to me that it's there somewhere for a lot of people at the top of their agendas. And that's really the first time that any of the three church bodies have consciously done that. So that's one example. Yeah.
Just have a question that goes sort of beyond inclusivity, and that is, we've been talking about that for quite a while now, but what are the mission strategies that you see in the ELCA that will help sort of be wellsprings that will enable that to happen?
Well, I think there are a number of strategies, and this is one of the struggles the church council has had. I mean, we've probably spent over the last year and a half more time dealing with the issue of, quote, outreach and how you spend that money. And one of the struggles is do we build more churches? Is that how we spend our money? We have a tendency as a church to define our success by how many new churches we have built in the year. In fact, there was a big controversy because when we went into the church, somebody way back when they weren't calculating very clearly and not understanding what a merger meant, said that we would start 1,200 new churches in a five-year period of time. And that meant, you know, something like 200 or 300 churches the first year. Well, I mean, anybody who understands anything about organizations coming together has got to know that that's not going to work. So I think the struggle and the interesting conversation took place at the church council over some adding money to outreach. And the question was, do we support organizations and groupings of people and churches and mission efforts that are already in place? And there are 1,100 of them. This church came in with 1,100 ministries that needed support. And those are ministries who are doing a lot of cutting edge work and are not going to be able to be self-supporting in the traditional sense. They're not in neighborhoods that in 5 years are going to be able to start paying back the money for their buildings. These are inner city, these are in rural areas, these are in a variety of different places of need. So the question is, do we start a whole bunch of new ministries or do we feed the money into those that are already existing, shore them up, and make them strong? And that was a real struggle. The church council actually came out probably more strongly on a very close vote, quite frankly, to support existing ministries first and then talk about new ministries. But that's only half of the question, half of the pie. My other issue is we continually look at the issue of evangelism and reaching out in terms of money and more buildings and hiring professional staff and those issues. Personally, I don't think we've ever looked at the major resource we have in the church, which is
people.
5.5 million people. I mean, you know, as a person who is trained as a community organizer, I have got to tell you, this is just like, you know, walking into, a gold mine. 5.5 million people. Why are we not organizing people? Why are we not turning people on to get out there and be about the business of being church in their lives? And part of it is because we've somehow figured in previous times, and I think all of the churches were certainly guilty of this, that we professionalized evangelism. We professionalized telling the story. And we convinced each other that the only way the story could be told is if you had a degree. And I can't tell you how many times I have spent at lay retreats, and these are presidents of congregations who've come up to me who've been staunch, strong church people, have given 20 hours a week for the last 25 years, and say to me, you know, I'm not very good at witnessing. It's one of the things that I don't do well. I think people are better at it who have some kind of a degree. And we've basically told people that they are no longer experts in their own faith. And I think one of the things that we have to really struggle with as a church is to figure out how we infuse people with the feeling that they too can go out and be about the business. And that ministry in daily life is really key to what it means to be church, I think, in the U.S. and the Caribbean in the 1990s and as we go into the year 2000. I think that's where we ought to be putting our resources. I think every congregation needs to deal with what it means to go out and talk to people in your community. What does it mean when I go to work and I have to deal with the issue of grace, and yet everything in my work is defined by getting paid for it? That's how people's value are defined. How do I struggle with that as a layperson? What does grace mean on one hand, and on the other hand, I have to make a decision as an administrator to value somebody by giving them a raise, an increase, and another person doesn't get it because they didn't do as good a work? You know, I think those are the nitty-gritty issues that we need to be struggling with. And, I've always challenged that we can spend $20 million a year on outreach, which I'm not saying we shouldn't. I'm not at all opposed to that. And we can maybe bring in 50,000 new members. If we turned on 2 million of our members of the ELCA and asked them to bring in one new member a year, we're talking 2 million people. And that's if you're into the numbers game. which I think we have to really question and think about. But I do think we have to stimulate people to do more than just go into church on Sunday and use that as their place of tradition and comfort. We need to challenge people. It has to be more than just a place like Holden. It has to be every Sunday, and we have to have a place every Sunday where you get renewed again, and you get the food again, and then you go out and you're about the business. That is some of the new stuff that I think is happening. I mean, I think there's a struggle with it, but when I say outreach, I'm talking a much broader term of outreach, and I think a lot of other people in the church are. I think that's occurring.
Yeah, and actually, you see, that's what my interview was about. And I agreed to interview because I just wanted to, well, I think you said it much better, Chris, than I said it, but that's exactly what I wanted to get across. And I was blown away that I was preaching to the choir, that these people way ahead of me, you know, had thought of that. I thought they would think more as you picked it previously.
Mm-hmm.
And even out here, even my friends who are the biggest cynics admit that there are stirrings that are happening, they don't know how it's happening, but the minute it is happening.
The spirit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
Kind of
right,
hanging out
right
there waiting for her time. Come on in.
How much of the, we were talking about this before, how much of the Mission 90 stuff is in place, and how much of it will do this kind of organizational work on a congregational level.
Are all of you aware of the Bishop Chilstrom's Mission 90? That's it's kind of like the new thrust that we're looking at doing over the next decade. Let me just give you a brief synopsis. I don't have it sitting in front of me, but heavens knows I've been to enough meetings about it. Basically, it's dealing with three words. See, grow, and serve are the three words. And the first is see, which is really a re-looking at who we are, kind of back to basics for Lutherans. That one of the feelings is that Lutherans have always assumed that we knew, you know, the small and large catechism very well. But boy, I tell you, try to pinpoint people and suddenly all that information is somewhere back there. You learned in confirmation. So some of it is dealing with issues like the one I just mentioned, which is grace. What does grace mean outside of that building I go to on Sunday? What does it mean in my life? And so there's going to be a whole series of videotapes done by Bishop Chilstrom in conjunction with other people. There'll be a number of lay people and other clergy people involved in it, but talking about some of those basic issues, dealing with those struggles. And that'll be sent out to all of the synods, and there'll be clergy and lay leaders and lay associates will be a part of being instructed around that, and that will then be taken to the congregations. I would really encourage you, and I'm gonna put in my little plugs along the way about what I would hope, is that when that happens in your synod, if you are a lay person, because clergy are automatically going to be a part of it, if you are a lay person who sees yourself in a leadership role, don't wait to be called. Go knocking. Go knocking at the door of the bishop and say, I want to be involved in this from the beginning, because one of my issues about Mission 90 is there's some great stuff in it, but it's got to take, you know, the church has got to take ownership of it, and it's going to come up at the assembly. So that's under C. And then the other thing under C is to really get people to think about, starting at the beginning of the Bible and really doing some biblical study and getting familiar with the Bible and comfortable with the Bible in maybe a different way than we've traditionally done that. Maybe with some different interpretation, some of the stuff that, for instance, I heard at Luther's Bible study this morning, you know, beginning to see the Bible with some new eyes. And as we move towards the year 2000, what does it have to say to us? So I think that's going to happen. Under Grow, there's some interesting things that are going to happen. One is a real focus on tithing. Basically, Lutherans are stingy, and we don't give very well. I mean, this is the bottom line. We give about 1%, maybe at the most 2% of our income. We're tight. I mean, we come out of some of those traditions. And, you know, and also, we like to make sure it's really safe first. We like to make sure the plan works before we invest in it. So I mean, this is not only true of being in the ELCA, it's certainly true all across the board. But we have not very frequently challenged our people to tithe. that we don't very often talk about the sacrifice of tithing and the joy of tithing. And my personal opinion is, yeah, I'd like to see a fair amount of that come to the church, but frankly, I'd like the people to tithe to whatever ministries they think are important. I mean, I think the bottom line is that what people need to do is say, yes, God, we accept your blessings, and this is the way we are going to thank you. And I think we find all kind of non-monetary ways of thanking because we like our little bank account. And so I think what we're going to be doing is saying, let's challenge each other. Can we tithe? Can this be a part of who we are? I know in my family, my parents were raised to tithe. That was the old tradition. That was the first check you wrote. And it still to this day is the first check I write out of my checking account. Sometimes it's a difficult one to write, especially when I'm really ticked off at the church. It's a really difficult one to write it out, you know. And I struggle with that a lot. But I do think that we need to challenge. I still remember the story of a woman who Bishop Chilstrom was talking to, and they were talking about tithing, and she finally said to Bishop Chilstrom, she says, you know the problem with you all? You never ask. And if you never ask, you never get. And I think that's true. So a big focus of that's going to be tithing. And I think how we do that, we need to be incredibly creative. I think we need to talk about what it means to tithe. I think it needs to be a conscious part of what we do in our life. And we need to talk about where that money's going. So at the same time, you get a connection to the tithing. It's just not giving it to something that you don't understand. There's also, within that grow part, there's going to be some resources focused on ministries that are struggling. Inner city churches that have maintained a membership of 100 for the last 15 years. Although they're doing incredible ministries within the basements of their churches, the sanctuaries are almost empty. What is it that, you know, that we're about? How do we connect up with our talking about, you know, God and our working within the community, as well as other churches in rural areas, et cetera, who are struggling? You know, we're going to have to struggle in this next 10 years in our church with the issue of closing churches. And particularly that's going to be happening in rural areas. And that's a real painful issue. I visited somebody this spring who was a pastor of a three-point parish. And I mean, literally, we're talking 10 miles apart. And all of them were struggling, and she was getting paid something like a salary of $13,000 a year. You know, $13,000. I mean, even in the middle of Wisconsin, $13,000 a year does not go far. And, you know, we talked about the issue of bringing all the churches together, and each community needed to hang on, partly because for that community, the church remaining there meant the town was still alive. And the minute the church moved, it was the beginning of the end. So I think we as a church really need to struggle with that issue, because you certainly can't kick people who are already being kicked. And we need to really struggle with that. So that's going to be part of the growth. The final one is serve. And that is one in which we're going to be asking. Now, this is all up at the assembly, who may vote it up or down. The all congregations will connect up with a domestic ministry. Does not have to be Lutheran. It can be any ministry you want, but every congregation will have some connection to another ministry in the country. That doesn't necessarily mean a fiscal connection. It could, but really what we're trying to do is get people to see beyond the walls of their church. And then second, to make a connection with the ministry internationally, or, you know, some project. And again, it doesn't have to be fiscal. I think really the focus of this, from Bishop Chilstrom's perspective, is really that people connect on a way that they, you know, speak to each other about their ministries rather than necessarily one supporting the other. And then the third is peace, justice, and the integrity of creation, which is the theme for the next decade of the World Council of Churches. And there's a lot of discussion about that, because there are a lot of people. I was just talking to the guy who a couple months ago, who's the secretary of Church and Society out of World Council of Churches, who's coordinating that program. And he says most groups that he's met throughout the world think it should be the integrity of creation, peace, and justice. And there's a lot of discussion about where those fit. But I think we're going to be using some of the materials and focus. And I got to thinking when we were talking this afternoon that wouldn't it be exciting if a place like Holden would take some of the issues of Mission 90 and really be creative and do something with them? I mean, there's just so much potential and possibility in a place like this that there's some cutting-edge kinds of things that could happen here that I think then could be moved beyond you know, Holden, and there's certainly other places in the church that are also doing cutting edge issues. But I think what we need to do with Mission 90 is the concepts are exciting, but if we don't make it ours, if we don't turn it into something that really makes sense in our own communities, it'll just be another one of those church programs that, poof, you know, you're going to hear a lot of PR about and then nothing happens with it. So, you know, one of the questions I would have for you is, how would you get ownership of that? Do you resonate to any of those things that I've just talked about in Mission 90? I mean, do they make any sense to you? Or are they places where you think the church ought to be at this particular time?
Part of it sounds really exciting to me, and it sort of answers part of the question I had. I live in the Portland area, and I know in metropolitan Portland, the number of Lutherans has not increased over 30 years. We've formed many mission congregations in the suburbs as they've grown, but then the inner-city churches have just sort of dwindled or disappeared. And that's a major problem, I think, in most cities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, the struggle for me, and this is just a personal one, that other people don't have as much a struggle with this, is, you know, you try not to get into the numbers game, because you can really get yourself pushed down a path. On the other hand, I go to church in an inner city parish that's a Spanish English parish, and frankly, we need more people. I mean, frankly, the 25 or 30 of us who are the core of the little worker bees are tired, and we really need some renewal. And I think, there's something kind of in between that. I do think it does go back to the issue of, are we ready to talk about our faith? I mean, somebody may or may not choose to be Lutheran, but I think the Lutheran Church, as well as some other ones, but I think the Lutheran Church has some real exciting things to offer about community. And I see people in especially urban areas, and I think it's true in suburban and rural, being really out of touch with community and just begging for a place to be, but it's got to be a place that accepts them for who they are. And so the issue really for us is, can we do that? Or are we going to try to mold them into what we think they ought to be like? And you know, we do that very subtly. You know, we do that when we walk into church on Sunday morning and you have to have 10 books in your hand to get through the service. You know, we got to go to the red book and then back to the green book, and oh yes, we have an exciting new piece here that we go for. So I mean, by the time I watch people in my church when they come, yeah, I mean, if I then I'm throw the whole thing up in the air and say, forget it. And I think that's some of the peace that we need kind of to deal with. But I do think that Lutheran Church needs to grow. The problem with the Lutheran Church is actually we do a fairly good job of getting people through the front door, but you know where they go then?
That's right.
The back door. I mean, we lose as many as we bring in, so we stay pretty stable in terms of our numbers, but we, you know, they're not staying, so why is that? You know, what is it that's stopping people from being a part of this community? And I think some of it is that we expect a lot of conformity. Yeah.
Talking about evangelism as a kind of a key, just reaching out, talking about the Bible with people, and just talking about what Christian church is about. And when you switched to international, I kind of got the feeling that was all service work as opposed to evangelism. Was I wrong?
Yeah, no, I certainly, if that's what it sounded like, I didn't mean that.
Well, I've heard it, being in Japan, missionaries there are very sensitive to that, and they're seeing that that's where a lot of money is diverted away from that, or to more sexy projects, where building a dam in Ethiopia, which is a very good thing,
yeah.
But it's easier to sell the congregation than it is sending a missionary to preach to people who have stereo television.
Yeah. I think our mission work is going to go through some radical changes. One of the changes is going to be is that some of the best and fastest growing churches are not happening in the Western Hemisphere. They're happening in the North. They're happening in the South. That if you look at some of the churches in Africa, they're growing by leaps and bounds. And frankly, we don't hold a candle to those churches around evangelism. I mean, we need to invite some of those people here to really give us the story and the way to do it. And I think that's we're only beginning to recognize that as an issue.
Pulling a few Koreans too.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, it's, you know, we're talking all over the world. In fact, we're doing probably one of the worst jobs jobs. But that's for a lot of reasons. Like, we struggle. We have a lot of barriers to talking about God in our society because we have so many things in front of that. The people have so many systems of security built up that it's kind of hard to get through some of those. So I think that that we our thinking needs to change about missions. That before, when we, you know, we're going to go and save the people of the world, now the question might come is, are we willing to be saved by other people in the world? And that's a struggle for us because it really means our willingness to listen to another group of people who are telling us about being church in a very different way. And can we listen to that? Are we willing to struggle with that? Some of the things that they're talking about is, should we be sending missionaries in the traditional sense from the U.S. to countries? What about sending missionaries intercontinentally? In other words, if the church in, you know, Ethiopia is growing by leaps and bounds and you want to start a church in, you know, some other part of Africa, why are we bringing somebody all the way from the United States to go there? Why aren't we taking some, you know, workers in Ethiopia and sending them to the places needed, you know, in other parts of Africa? And I think it's true in Asia and other places. That I'm not suggesting that that doesn't mean that those none of those areas need to have people come from here, because I think there is a great need. I'm just suggesting that we're going to have to radically change our thinking about that, because I think the vitality of the church in the Southern Hemisphere is really incredible, and we need to be willing to be opened up and to harness some of that vitality. Because I think there are things to be said from those churches that we have not even yet to begun to hear. I mean, when I listen to when I go to international conferences and I listen to some of the people talk from South Africa and Namibia and other parts of Africa who are in, for all intents and purposes, living in incredibly hopeless situations, who can talk about the hope of the gospel and the movement of the gospel in their lives, I think those are stories we need to hear and take to heart. So I think we're going to see some radical change. I think the service stuff is there. I mean, frankly, we got the money. We have a lot of the technical skills, and we need to give them, and we need to make them a part of that. But I think they have something that that we're maybe not quite ready to acknowledge yet, but I hope we do soon, because
so
it's
talking,
real important.
And being more concrete, you're talking about cooperating more with the like the Lutheran World Federation.
Oh yeah, I think we have strong cooperation. I think everything we do needs to be really interconnected with Lutheran World Federation. Right, definitely.
That answers one of my questions, because I have spent some time in Indonesia, and the Lutheran Church there is the Christian Church of Indonesia, basically. And one of the Indonesian pastors I had spoken to him in Chicago, and he was part of a task force that is talking about this new concept that, you know, maybe we need to invert the way we've been doing it. And he was asked, you know, well, what do you think you have to offer us? And he said the only thing he could do was laugh, because that seems so ludicrous to them, because they are witnessing a lot of mm-hmm. They can see exactly why we aren't tithing and why, you know, why we are thinking in numbers, and it's very obvious, I think, to the rest of the world what our problem is in America.
So they may have some perspectives,
right,
that would be helpful.
And
right,
that brings up the other question I had as far as being younger. That experience for me has given me that hope in the church, and that I wonder how much is going on with, you know, how many of the people that you're bringing in the front door or going out the back door or whatever, what, how much of it is youth or younger people?
Well, I think the issue of young people in terms of the church is a real crucial one. One of the things that Bishop Chilstrom has focused on in the Mission 90 is a lot of those activities and programs, et cetera, are going to be focused on a younger age group, you know, young adults and adolescents, et cetera, in that period where I think the church has ignored. We do real well around issues about national gatherings, and I mean, we can get 20,000 kids to come to San Antonio to a national gathering, and that's real exciting for them. Where we really struggle with is the issue of keeping them in the church after confirmation. I mean, that's really the place that we lose a lot. I think a lot of that relates to the fact that we can't talk about ministry in daily life. If you don't somehow relate people's faith to the date that they go on Friday night and what that means, you know, and the decisions that they make in their lives and the choices that they make for their careers and all of those kinds of things, why bother? I mean, sometimes you really have to knock hard on the church and the door of the church to get them to see your gifts. And people get tired of knocking. And they go away and they find another place. So I think we really need to struggle a lot with how to use those gifts and how to not assume that the only value in the church has to do with age. I mean, frankly, I deal with that. I have to struggle with that somewhat. I mean, and not that I'm so very young. In comparison.
Record that?
Yeah. No.
It's on tape.
Yeah, right. That sometimes, you know, one gets tired of constantly proving themselves. That somehow the church has got to accept, you know, all of the gifts of people, and sometimes that means inexperienced gifts. So, I mean, I just really push young people to just hang in there and to keep knocking.
Yeah,
and we
well
just
my,
have to keep knocking.
Yeah, my concern is that I think that the perspective issue that people from Indonesia would have to offer are the youth have equally
right.
as valuable perspectives that are pretty revealing for our people.
Right. Good. I'll have to remember who you are because there are all kinds of things and groups that maybe you could kind of share that experience with. So let's talk afterwards. Yeah.
We had a missionary come to our church a few weeks ago, and he was saying, you know, how they had like 6,000 people come on a Sunday morning to the church, and 2,000 get inside the building, 4,000 are standing outside. And someone from our congregation posed the question, how do you get that many people to come, you know, look at our congregation? And he said, pointed to the clock. You don't pay any attention to time. They come at 9 and they go home at 3.
Right. Can you? And the sermon isn't only 12 minutes long?
Right.
Right, yeah. Well, I think, you know, and I think those are people that's adjusting to kind of the difference in what people see or want or feel culturally. I mean, the tendency is that we fit church into a slot in our lives. It's Sunday morning, it's this time to this time. And I mean, it's a phrase I repeat a lot. If we don't get serious about ministry and daily life, we're dead in the water by the year 2000. We'll still be here. It'll still be the ELCA, but it will not be a vital church. That if we don't get serious about that, we might as well, you know, kind of just move on, because that's the key. It's the priesthood of all believers, and we kind of mouth all the words and we talk about it, but we just don't do a lot about it. And I think people are feeling that and moving to places and churches and groups where they feel their talents and their struggles in their jobs are struggles that are, you know, are talked about within the context of the church community. I think that's happening. I'm not saying that that's not. I'm just saying we need to continually remind ourselves, and it is a struggle. Yeah.
Well, and I struggle with that issue daily, too, because I'm definitely trying to bring my work life in with some liaison with the church and what I do with the church. And I'm a commissioner of human rights among the cities in the state of Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been trying to bring that human rights issue with me to church and an educational group that's discussing the gay and lesbian issues in the Twin Cities and the broader ELCA. And I'm finding it difficult for me to find the lack of acceptance, the lack of acceptance of differences and the fear. And I don't know where that's going to go in the church, but it's been hard, and it's hard to keep my motivation up. And yeah, I won't leave, but
you're saying you don't know where the whole gay lesbian issue is going to go in this church.
No.
Well,
I don't have a lot of hope for it right now.
A lot of us don't know where. A couple people asked me that question. We might as well kind of get to that question. Do you want to ask your question tied into? Do you have a specific question tied into that?
No, it's just wanting to know what the stance of on that issue.
Okay, before I say that, I just want to respond to kind of that struggle. It's a similar one for me. I mean, all the stuff that, in terms of the ethical issues that I've been dealing with the week here around reproductive health, are not issues that the church is readily willing to hear. This is probably, I've been in the field for 20 years, and only in the last two or three years has there even been any indication of interest in some of those things. So I think that one has to just hang in there around certain issues. There are people who are interested. The question is not interest. The question is kind of figuring out how to get it in to the institution. So I would just, you know, encourage you to continue that struggle as I know it's hard because I go through it every day. I mean, sometimes I sit on the balcony of my house and I say, why do I bother? I mean, it could be a lot easier someplace else. I mean, against that knocking at the door kind of thing. But, I just kind of figure maybe it's a lifetime, you know, commitment that one makes to the whole process. In terms of homosexuality, well, that's a hot issue, certainly. And I think it's one that we're going to have to struggle with as a church. The problem right now is that we have a tendency as a church people have a tendency to react immediately and say, I don't want to discuss it, I don't want to say anything about it, et cetera, because people are afraid. I mean, there's a lot of fear in terms of talking about that. We've never been a church that's done well around the issue of sexuality, period. And we're going to have to deal with it. I mean, there's some real issues around sexuality that impact our lives. And I will tell you, things like AIDS are forcing us to deal with them. Even though it's the back door, somehow or another we're going to have to struggle with those issues. You know, what does it mean to express your sexuality in the context of being a Christian? You know, what does that all mean for you in your individual life? I mean, those are difficult questions, and the church isn't there oftentimes to answer it except to say no. Well, if you've been in the field as long as I have around sexuality, just say no doesn't work. It never has, and the phrase when it came out never will work, and everybody in the field who works knows it doesn't work. Just say no is not enough. We need to talk to people about what it means to express their sexuality in the context of modern times. And I think homosexuality gets thrown into that pot. So in many ways, I see the whole discussion around homosexuality being a part of a larger discussion on sexuality within our culture, within our church. And we need to see it in that context because there's a lot of pain now happening in our church related to that. And we have a tendency either to ignore it or we become legalistic about it. I mean, we seem to fall on either side, and somehow we don't get in the process of discussing what it means in our individual lives. I think in terms of the question of ordination of practicing gays, if you were to ask me my prediction of whether it's going to happen in the Lutheran Church in the near future, I'd say no. It hasn't happened in any of the mainline churches currently in this country. The Methodists turned it down a year ago, in fact, almost split in convention over it. The Presbyterians talked about it this time and turned it down. Anybody who's aware of the Church in Canada, the United Church in Canada, which did vote for it, is being split as a church. I don't see Lutherans doing that right now. And I was talking to a group of seminarians recently who asked the question, you know, why aren't Lutherans doing that? Why is this? Why? I said, well, tell me what church you're going to be a pastor in. They said the Lutheran Church. I said, think what you're talking about here. I mean, the church for years has said that homosexuality is wrong. Some people have come to a different conclusion, a number of clergy, a number of theologians, and have made some decisions that it should change, and, you know, it's a justice issue, and that might rightly be so. But somehow or another, lay people got left behind. Nobody ever bothered to have the discussion in the congregations, and I think it's still there. Where, you know, theologians and people, professors at seminaries, are still afraid to write articles about it. Well, nobody wants to be asked to write an article for fear that it's going to brand them. So I think we need to set a safe environment in the ELCA in order to have the discussion. We need to say to each other, it's okay to have the discussion. It's okay to have all the diversity of opinions, and we need to struggle with it and see where we come out on it. Right now, what the bishops have said is that they will ordain gay candidates who agree to be celibate, basically. Much the same way that they talk about ordaining a heterosexual candidate that is single who agrees to be celibate. And that's where it is right now, and frankly, that's where I see it. More important to me at this point, from a strategy point of view, is the issue of ministry to gay and lesbians. That's where I think we need to struggle at this point. We figure, if you take our church as kind of a reflection of the national population, 10% of the ELCA are gay and lesbians. 10%. So what? Out of 5.5 million people, that is, what is it? Is it 500,000? Okay, that's a lot of people. What are we doing?
Where did they get that figure? That figure, I don't think is realistic. Phil Donahue had a program in which Exodus International presented their program of helping homos become heterosexual. They've done some wonderful work along that line, and they claim that figure is way too high. That perhaps it's between 2% and 5%, and I don't know where they get 10%.
I think that it's basically social research in terms of guesstimates based on certain populations.
Guesstimates.
A lot of those figures are guesstimates in terms, and we accept a lot of those. Obviously, there are other people who might not feel who are doing different kinds of work that might choose to think that it's much lower, but. You know, whatever the figures are, what I'm saying is gay and lesbian people are a part of the ELCA, and there's a question of ministry. And I think that we as a church need to be about ministry in those communities. And I think we'll have to struggle with what that means. But I think that's a key. That's a start. And I think the second piece is the discussion. Can we make our church a safe place for the discussion where people are not afraid to express their opinions on either side, in either area? And I think if we can attain that, we've gone a long way in figuring out how we're going to struggle through the particular issue. You know, and that's painful for a lot of gay and lesbians to hear, but that's how I envision the reality of it. I think that... we have been a church that has allowed for diversity, but we've also been a church that also quiets ourselves up and censors ourselves before we even speak for fear of what other people will think of us. And somehow we have to move out of that mode and open up the forum so that people can really have their say in the process. Yeah.
The Eastern and Washington Idaho Convention discussed this, I thought, very well this year, and passed a motion affirming ministry to the gay and lesbian. But at the same time, stand behind the bishop in terms of ordination, faithfulness, and celibacy.
Right. So yes, there are some assemblies and synods who are dealing with it, and in the Northern California, Northern Nevada Synod, there is a the possibility of an ordination that wouldn't take place with the sanction of the church. But we're still struggling through that particular one. And who knows what'll happen with that. But I think at this point what we're really struggling with is how to get the conversation and dialogue happening in the church.
I just had a letter from a former student of mine who goes to this church in California that they have just voted through the whole congregation, a unanimous vote, to hire a homosexual pastor.
And
he
said,
they've given him a call. And he said, we don't know what haven't determined what the bishop has said yet, and we may be put out of the church at large, but we're willing to take a risk as far as the congregation, and they were real happy that it was a unanimous vote by all of them to call him.
Yeah.
And I was real glad to hear this from you.
I don't know if that also is in conjunction with this person, a PLTS student who was just graduating from seminary and apparently had had 40-some, you probably know more about this than that, I just read about it in the Chronicle, that it had 40-some pastors and other people in the Lutheran Church support his ordination. Do you know?
Mm-hmm. Jeff Johnson. That's the situation. Actually, there are a number of people who support Jeff's ministry. It's that there are not 40 pastors who support his ordination. There are many people who support the issue of ordaining openly gay people but are not willing to go against church polity because they don't feel that this is the time or the strategy to do that. So in fact, that number is much fewer, and there's probably a fewer number of people. In that particular situation, if that congregation chooses to ordain that person, it will not be officially recognized by the ELCA. And there probably will be some disciplinary action, because in fact, that's what has to happen. It's the same thing that would occur if somebody chose not to accept the guidelines of the Constitution of the ELCA around inclusivity and said, we don't believe in quotas, we're not going to follow them, and therefore, poof. That's probably what's going to happen. And frankly, there's a lot of discussion in the community of people who support the issue of ordination of gays around that particular strategy, because many people feel it's not the right time. There is not a groundswelling of support for that in the Lutheran Church. There's just not. And there may be, but as I said to somebody earlier, I think that we are remiss in the fact that we haven't done our educating. And that's really what needs to take place at this time. So
I think
that's the
struggle. I was just wondering if the parish itself is feeling somebody's got to stand up and do it first.
I think there are two parishes that are going to do it. There's one on East in San Francisco, and there's one in Oakland. And I think that's probably true. There are a lot of people who, as I said before, disagree with that strategy, who don't feel that that's an appropriate way to deal with the issue. So we'll see what happens with it.
I don't want to oversimplify this thing, but God certainly loves a Christian gay person or lesbian. We're supposed to love them if we're Christians, and yet we're talking constantly about the church's stand on what we're going to do with these people, like they're an enemy of ours. Let's have a meeting tonight on what are we going to do about the black people that are coming into our congregation. Mm-hmm. What's the church's stand on it? Like they're from outer space. And so even if we think what they're doing is wrong and sinful, let's not have a service where only the non-sinners attend, or you're going to have a bunch of vacant churches. I don't want to oversimplify this. I know it is a problem, but sometimes I think we overlook the fact that we're sitting in judgment.
Mm-hmm.
in our way to take a stand. The stand is we're Christians and we love you. This man here is here, he's a Christian, I don't know him, he could be gay, but I should love him, I should listen to his problems, I should be there to help him. Who's my neighbor? We're back to what the kids said tonight.
Right.
Who's my neighbor?
Mm-hmm. The problem is that the church has not traditionally taken that, has not taught that, and therefore people need to be re-educated. It's not very fair to expect people who've learned one way all of their life to suddenly assume that they're going to change because a bunch of people have gone through their own consciousness raising. We need to go through the process of education, and that's what we're talking about. I think the very thing you said, I don't think you're oversimplifying. I think, in fact, that's at the basis of the truth, and that's one of the reasons why there are many in the church who feel that the focus on ministry to gay and lesbians is a much more reasonable way and thought-provoking way to deal with the issue of homosexuality in the church, rather than focusing on the ordination question. Frankly, as a layperson, the ordination question is not at the top of my list. I'm much more concerned about what we're doing in ministry in my community in San Francisco with gay and lesbians. And that's a much more crucial question. So I think it's an issue we're going to struggle with as a church. And the minute we stop talking about it, I think we're going to be in trouble. Yeah.
I want to change the issue. In Germany, where I come from, the Lutheran Church is large middle class. It has lost the workers and so on, and also the very high educated people. And I guess it's the same with the Lutheran Church in America. What are you going to do with the workers and those who have no rights in society?
Well, I think that's a struggle for the ELCA because we are traditionally a pretty middle-class church. In terms of, we're a very well-to-do church. We have a fairly good set of bank accounts. in the ELCA overall. I think that there are places where that's not true, and there's places where it's radically changing. I think in rural areas where farmers used to be very wealthy and a part of the church, that's changing, and suddenly you're dealing with people who have flipped into another place in their lives. I think in urban areas where the churches are, that's the struggle with the churches. There are a lot of people, low-income people, a lot of people who are struggling just to survive in the city, just to be able to stay in the city. That goes back to that issue of inclusivity. Is the expectation of the church opening up its arms one in which you say you have to act a certain way in order to get through the door? Or is the expectation that you accept people from a community where they are for who they are? And I think all of the strategies that I've talked about previously relate to that question. I think there's a move and a conscious move to increase the number of people of color and primary language other than English. That's a difficult one because we're not a church that's seen, that's identified traditionally with a variety of different ethnic groups, except in some cases, in urban areas and in certain. Interestingly enough, the church that did probably the most comprehensive work in the black community, Lutheran Church in this country, was the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Consequently, they have the largest number of black members, which is a very conservative church in many ways, but chose to do work in that area. I think it's just a matter of becoming conscious and being willing to work and recruiting church workers who are black, Hispanic, Asian, who can work in those communities. And what that means for us is we may have to be open to all the hoops that we require people to go through in order to become, quote, church workers. We may need to do some experiments and do some different kinds of things with people that we're accepting in terms of church work. In the congregation that I belong to, I'll be honest with you, it's primarily Hispanic, and it's Hispanic and English, but in the Hispanic population, it's primarily from Central America. And frankly, I think people are as comfortable in that church as they are in the Catholic church down the street. And for whatever reason, they've chosen that church. And the reason is because of community. There's a sense of community there. And these are people in real pain because they've come out of war-torn countries. Their families, half of their families are still there. And that's what people are looking for. And I think if we can make a place of community for people, then I think people will become a part of it. But it's a struggle because it means being something different. Yeah.
On a different issue, do you think there's any future for religious communities for single people in the sort of the traditional historic sense of living together in a common place, with or without promises of some kind?
Right. I know that there's been some movement in that direction, very small and a very small group. I never would think about saying no to any possibility. I think one would have to look very carefully at why a religious community was going to be there. That would be the question. What is it that community offers the church and the people within it? And I think those questions need to be discussed. But I certainly think that that the issue of spirituality and some of those questions are issues that are popping up in the church. And I know that a lot of people respond to that by looking at other religious communities and seeing that happening. I just think that as a church, what you need to ask first is, okay, why are we doing this and how does it affect the whole community in terms of the small community? And then in answering that question, then those things can grow. There's a lot of possibility of things. I mean, When the spirit hits, things move in a way that sometimes we're not quite ready to deal with. And I think that there is a stirring among people to do things in a different way. I would just say that we need to make sure that we think about them and talk about them and not alienate ourselves from the larger community in order to do it. Mm-hmm. So I would never assume that it's not a possibility, but currently now it's a pretty small, mm-hmm. Movement.
Thanks.
Let me get back here. Yeah.
Yes, the hot issue at the Northern Illinois Synod Convention this summer was the divestment issue. How can we move toward divestment while at the same time respecting the legal understanding that the pension board has about their responsibilities?
Their fiduciary responsibilities.
Yes. And I guess as an attorney I have some some feeling for the pension board on this, and yet I support divestment.
Right. Well, I think one thing is to make those feelings known. I always encourage people to write letters to the Board of Pension to encourage them to divest, because they always tell me how many anti-letters they get. So it's very clear where our church is around divestment. We are clearly in support of divestment. We've said it in convention. It's going to come up in another resolution, this assembly. And I think the church council has struggled with this issue with the Board of Pensions. It is true that the issue of fiduciary responsibility, which basically means you need to make sure that you invest, don't lose money based on investing for social reasons. The one issue that the church council has struggled with and feels that probably eventually needs to be answered is, and this has never been answered in a court, is the question of, does the mission of the church supersede fiduciary responsibility? And that's a question that needs to be posed and looked at in terms of some legal issues. In other words, if a church doesn't believe in drinking and in taking drugs, and you're investing your pension plan, and you refuse to invest in drug companies or alcohol companies, even though they have a very strong portfolio,
yes,
are you exercising correct fiduciary responsibility? We don't invest in alcohol, in companies that make alcohol for the most part. And the ALC for years, one of the previous church bodies, never did, or tobacco. And somehow we survived fiduciary responsibility within that context. So I think that in some cases, while I certainly appreciate the dilemma that the Board of Pension find them in, and by the way, there's disagreement among the board about fiduciary responsibility, so that's one issue. While there's some disagreement related to that, I think that we could see, and certainly the Church Council has expressed on numerous occasions, a move to move them faster out of their investments. The other concern that happened this spring is not only they did move out of some investments and they, you know, had a little calendar, but they also reinvested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand.
And that caused some great concern with the Church Council, and I certainly would hope that that issue would be touched on the floor of the convention. Of course, I would not like to promote that discussion.